sanctioning hate today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The White House stands by President Trump's retweets of anti-Muslim videos posted by a British far-right group. And this British politician says it's making things awkward.
We are in the deeply disturbing situation where the president of our major partner country has sanctioned and given credence to this bizarre fringe organization.
Plus, an undocumented immigrant in Florida helps kids in her community with their dental care.
And if it wasn't for the services that I help provide, the kids would not get the dental services that they need.
Now she fears deportation. The story is today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us. Each day, we do our level best to put you in someone else's shoes on this planet. So here's where we start today. Imagine you've lived in the U.S. nearly your entire life. You have a job here, a family. And now you find yourself facing uncertainty and possible deportation. Hundreds of thousands of young undocumented immigrants don't have to imagine that. They've been able to stay and work in the U.S. legally thanks to DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, started under President Obama but now being phased out by President Trump. Here's reporter Tipa Fernandez with the story of one DACA recipient, a health worker in Florida.
Magali Torres is a dental assistant and loves it when preschoolers open their mouths real big for her to peer in.
A ver tus dientes.
They make such funny faces, she often has to stifle a laugh. They also tell her stories. This child launches into a big story about not going to the dentist because he's sick. Torres nods sympathetically. Torres works in a migrant Head Start center in Immokalee, a small agricultural city in southwestern Florida. A lot of people, immigrants from Latin America, live here. A lot of kids coming from farming families. Some are undocumented. Most probably wouldn't see a dentist if not for Torres.
I didn't really go to the dentist until I was an adult and I was able to pay for it on my own.
Torres, she's from a farming family too. Her parents worked the fields from the minute they arrived to Immokalee from Mexico. Torres was just 7.
And I see myself in those kids. I was those kids.
She breaks down. She says her parents struggled to provide her with what she needed. That motivates her work today as a nurse assistant at this community center.
And if it wasn't for the services that we provide and that I help provide, the kids would not get the dental services that they need.
Torres was born in Matamoros in northern Mexico, bordering Texas. She remembers staying indoors because of the dangers from drug cartels outside. She didn't even realize on the day her mother packed her into the car and they drove off to Florida, they would never return. But, Torres says, her mother did the right thing. Matamoros wasn't safe. And being undocumented in the U.S., well, it didn't seem to matter until she was in 11th grade.
When people started taking the SATs, ACTs to go to school, and I knew I would be unable to continue my education.
She wanted to go to college. Florida has good schools, she says. All her friends were applying.
And it was hard because I did have good grades. And we would all have to go see our guidance counselor. He would tell me, he didn't know at the time my legal status. He would tell me, with your grades, you could go to any school you want, most likely be able to get a scholarship. I acted like I wasn't interested.
She pushed away thoughts of college, got married, had kids. Then she figured out a way to study.
I went to a technical college here in Immokalee. Even before I got my work permit, I had already went and signed up for their licensed practical nursing program.
She got that work permit through DACA, a program started by Obama that granted permits to people like Torres who came to the U.S. as kids. She says the permit was a blessing, not just because she could attend school and work legally, but because she could worry about deportation less.
Unless you live it, you will never understand how that feels. And DACA has given me peace of mind that I'm going to see my kids at the end of the day.
But now Trump is ending DACA. He says it rewards people who've lived in the U.S. without papers. Torres faces a 2019 deadline when her work permit expires and is under a lot of pressure to figure out another way to stay here legally. So, to keep from worrying so much, she busies herself, volunteering. On Mondays, she trains kids at a church to be altar servers.
Yeah, next time you're going to do it for real, Adriana. We got a couple of more minutes. One more minute, one more person to try it with the incense, and then we have to go back because I have an announcement.
After one of those trainings, alone in the cavernous church, I ask her about the proposal in Congress that would offer DACA recipients a fix, a way to stay legally, but that it might not protect their undocumented parents.
Do you feel like the DACA community, that you'd be okay with that?
No, we would not. It's something that when it, if it does come, we would probably organize protests and try and make it so that doesn't happen.
She says her parents got legal status. They're okay now. But she knows others like her who fear their parents will get deported while they get to stay.
A lot of us DACA recipients are activists, so we would not just let that happen. We would fight, protest, and try and make it so our parents can stay here as well.
It's late now, and Torres heads home to her own children. Homework to check, dinner to cook. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Immokalee, Florida.
There are nearly 800,000 stories like the one we just heard. That's how many DACA recipients there are. And beyond that, there are millions of other immigrant stories in this country. Telling them has been a core mission of New America Media. It started after the Vietnam War as the Pacific News Service in San Francisco. And for decades since, it's nurtured journalists who worked for ethnic media outlets and stood out as examples of diversity and civic engagement in journalism. But now New America Media is about to close its doors. Andrew Lam is a Vietnamese-American writer who's worked for New America Media for more than 25 years. Tell us how you joined what was then Pacific News Service. Were you planning to be a journalist?
Not at all. I was a graduate student in the creative writing department at San Francisco State, and an essay of mine somehow found its way to the hand of Sandy Close and Fran Sherman, her husband, who were a couple that were running the Pacific News Service wire, and they invited me to join the editorial meeting, and next thing you know, I started writing for them.
So what was the mission of Pacific News Service? How would you describe it?
Well, originally PNS started as a wire service. It was an alternative view of the Vietnam War. So it concentrated on writing about the U.S. in Vietnam. But after the war, it started to turn inward and looked at domestic issues, you know, race relations, immigration, and then, of course, Central America, which was getting hot later on. When I was hired, it was the time of the end of the Cold War, right after Tiananmen Square and the Berlin Wall fell. And so then the fascination then was the global local angle, how human movement is changing everything and how the borders became porous. And the narrative shifted toward a point of view of a globalized society. And, you know, I was in the thick of it.
You've mentioned before that New America Media kind of felt like a home for outcasts. Tell me more about those people. I mean, what do you mean exactly?
Well, if you walk into the office back in the day, about 10 years ago, you would see birds flying because the boss,
really?
Our boss, Sandy, she loves parakeets and they fly everywhere. And then you have people who bring their comfort dogs in, so you have dogs running. And our editorial meeting can be as far flung as having someone who comes from the street and is a drug addict telling us why, you know, certain program doesn't work, to, you know, intellectual who comes from Berkeley to tell us about his latest research. So it's always a fun and unexpected place, you know, because it's kind of horizontal and everyone's treated equal with their point of view. I met over 1,000 people whose lives are fascinating and sad, and some of them are transformative, you know. It wasn't just a newsroom. It was sort of like a place of life.
So why is New America Media shutting down? I mean, it seems like an ideal source of news and storytelling for these times.
I would say that it has to do with the schizophrenic nature of what we became, moving from a wire service to a media entity that basically uplifted ethnic and alternative media out of their silo. But in the process, we kind of lost our own identity, in my point of view. I think we couldn't decide if we were still a media entity or we were a media supporter, public relation entity doing a lot of messaging. And so a time when, as you know, the media world is in turmoil, there's less and less support for actual journalism. I think we flounder in terms of how we decided to go forward.
I mean, it seems like a shame. What will the loss of New America Media mean for journalism in the U.S. right now? And for you personally, what does it mean?
You know, it's been my home for 25 years, so it's almost been homeless in a sense. But I take comfort in knowing that our idea of inclusive journalism, of allowing the homeless and the immigrant to speak up in their own term, that idea had prospered and lived on. I mean, the conversation continues. And in that sense, I find comfort in it. So, you know, I'll continue to do what I've been passionate about. But in terms of having a home, it's no longer there.
Andrew Lam is a Vietnamese-American writer who's worked for New America Media for more than 25 years. New America Media now shutting down. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Another way this show helps put you in other people's shoes is by looking at how everyone around the globe kind of has the same routines, like commuting, except the commute we're going to hear about is unique. In Medellin, Colombia, some people use cable cars to travel between the city's affluent downtown and poorer neighborhoods in the surrounding hills. Think ski gondolas at luxury mountain resorts. Except in Medellin, they're a lifeline for neighborhoods that were previously considered off-limits. Our guide is my BBC Mundo colleague, Arturo Wallace. He was based in Colombia for several years, and he's taken the gondolas in Medellin many times.
It's quite an experience. You have the gondolas coming the whole time. They never stop. You have actually to climb them as they move, as you would do in a ski station. And you start to climb. You're flying, basically, over the roofs of these houses. You see everything that's going down there. Sometimes you can take a peek through the windows. You see their lining drying under the sun, little plants and flower pots they might have in their balconies, houses that keep growing and growing, you know, like they build something and then when they have a little money, they add an extra floor and so on and so forth. Climbing these very steep hills is quite a journey, you know. It's quite a journey in many, many ways because it's not only a trip in a geographic sense, but it takes you, you know, to a very different reality, so to speak. Many Latin American cities, you have the poorest people in the hills and the rich ones, the wealthy people living in the valley. Many of these people came from other parts of the country, fleeing lengthy and cruel civil war, you know, more than 50 years of Marxist guerrillas fighting against the state, but also because of the presence of drug traffickers. Medellin is the city of Pablo Escobar, and most of these comunas, you know, like situated on the hills that surround Medellin, were also quite strategic for the guerrillas, for the paramilitaries who fought against the guerrillas, and then for the drug lords. The whole idea of using, you know, like cable cars to reach them was part of a conscious decision of the Medellin authorities to try to change the dynamics of these parts of Medellin by connecting them to the rest of the city with everything that entails, you know, job opportunities, education opportunities, the possibility of exposing themselves to other influences, not only these warlords. I think it has worked. If you go there and talk to the people who live there, they say that things are certainly by no means perfect, but Metrocablo has made a huge impact, making themselves proud about the places where they live and reducing the stigma that was associated with those areas, because now other people from the city can go there and go there to visit, and they discover that, well, you know, that people, they are very similar to us, they're just like us, and that certainly is quite an important change.
Arturo Wallace there telling us about the cable cars in Medellin, Colombia. A big thanks to our friends with the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast for that story. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman with the world. President Trump's proposed ban on transgender people in the military has been blocked by the courts twice, but an appeal is pending, so it could still happen. An interesting contrast with the news from Canada this week. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau issued an apology for a program that for 30 years, up until the 1990s, basically purged gay, lesbian, and transgender people from the Canadian military and government.
It is with shame and sorrow and deep regret for the things we have done that I stand here today and say we were wrong. We apologize. I am sorry. We are sorry.
Simon Thwaites waited a long time to hear those words. Back in 1986, he was serving in Canada's Navy as a surveillance analyst. At the time, he'd just been diagnosed as HIV positive when he was called in for questioning.
I was just going to my regular job, doing work like you would sort of normally do, and I was told to report down to this building in Halifax, and when I get there, it's two military police or special investigation unit at the time, and they basically stuck me in a room with a lie detector machine and started asking me questions about being gay and also about my medical status. They wanted to know who I knew and who was around me and all sorts of very personalized questions.
Wow. Lie detector machine, and they wanted you to name names. Were you terrified?
Oh, they wanted names. And then, of course, I was being followed. That was the other part of this, is that I started realizing that while I was walking around places in Halifax and other places, I was being tailed. And it was well known that this special unit was up in certain areas in town, and they were taking pictures of people who were associating with you. So it not only became about me, it became about the people who were actually with me. And I do know that one or two of the people around me were actually pulled in and asked about, how do you know this individual? You know, what's your relationship? And who do you know?
Were you scared?
I think it was more disbelief. It is like watching one of those old black and white World War One movies, you know, where you see the Germans interrogating people and then you see the Nazis following you around. It was nearly surreal. It was like unbelievable. You just kind of moved on and you did, but you kind of knew in the back. So over the years, I've kind of built up this distrust, I guess, of the government and the military and that, because I always expect that there's someone down the corner, like, watching me or someone, right?
So what happened after this interrogation? Were you punished?
Well, the thing that they did is they take away your security clearance, which is what they did to me, which, of course, then meant I couldn't do my job. So then I had to be what I call misemployed. So I ended up doing things like sweeping the drill shed floor and washing dishes and pots and pans, which in the military, that's normally considered a punishment. And I was also told not to talk to my friends and other members that, you know, I belonged to a ship, and I was pulled off the ship and put on land. So it became really a feeling of isolation as well. So you don't know really what to do. You try to go for the motions, but you really didn't know what they were doing because no one's telling you anything.
Eventually, Thwaites was forced out of the military on a medical release, but without medical benefits. He lost his house and filed for bankruptcy. And now Thwaites is part of a class action lawsuit against the Canadian government. I asked him about that. I imagine that you have spoken with a lot of the people in this lawsuit. I mean, you must find very similar themes in all of your stories.
You're correct, actually, there. One of the common threads I noticed was that we were pulled aside. We were isolated, and then we were around us this built of mistrust, this you didn't know what was going on, and then eventually the manipulation to either try to get you to release, you know, to get out of the forces voluntarily through an administrator that, you know, you just got out. You just signed the papers and got out of there because the treatment you're getting was just crazy. Or they just released you anyway and said, oh, well, we don't need you anymore because you're not doing your job.
So you were invited to Ottawa for Prime Minister Trudeau's apology. Did you make it?
I actually did make it. I wasn't going to be able to make it because of my financial situation. And I'd explained to them that, you know, because of the way things happen, I'm on a really limited income.
Yeah.
So I actually got a call from the secretariat in the government and that, who put me in contact with the individuals up there. And they actually made it so my plane ticket and the hotel would be covered and that I could get there. So at the very last minute, literally days before, it kind of all fell in place that I actually did get up there and I was able to actually be in the room in the House of the Parliament and actually hear the words come out of the Prime Minister's mouth. And that was pretty great.
Simon Thwaites was forced out of the Canadian military during the gay purge. Simon, thank you very much for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Don't expect any apologies from officials in Egypt anytime soon about an ongoing crackdown there against the LGBTQ community. It started by some accounts back in September. Tyra Demant is the director of Amnesty International's Gender, Sexuality, and Identity program. How widespread is this crackdown, and how many people are we talking about at this point?
We're looking at least in the last 2 months of more than 70 LGBT people who've been arrested. On Monday, 14 men were convicted, and on Sunday, and two more on Monday of so-called debauchery. And these men were sentenced to 3 years in prison. But this is part of a much wider crackdown that we're seeing in Egypt against specifically LGBT people and human rights defenders.
Charges of debauchery, what does that even entail?
So the debauchery laws originally written by the Egyptian parliament are specific to prostitution, but they've been used to target gay men particularly or perceived gay men. In this latest crackdown, authorities even went on online dating sites to try to entrap and successfully entrap gay men or men perceived to be gay.
And so what has all this done to members of the LGBTQ community in Egypt?
As you can imagine, wondering whether or not someone who you think you're going to meet on a date or to talk in safety ends up being a police officer who's ready to arrest you, there's tremendous fear across the LGBT community. And that's being fueled not only by these arrests, but by Parliament and state TV. The Parliament, over 60 MPs have introduced or tried to introduce a law that would specifically criminalize same-sex sexual behavior. So this would take that debauchery law and specifically target LGBT people.
Why do you think this crackdown is getting worse?
Unfortunately, we've seen these types of crackdowns in multiple places, particularly targeting LGBT people. And in Egypt, it's part of a much broader crackdown of human rights groups. Last year, in February, the Egyptian government physically sealed shut the doors of the El Nadim Center, which is a prominent NGO that helps victims of torture. In November, they passed what's called this NGO law, which places restrictions on civil society organizations and their activities. And the crackdown on LGBT people is part of that narrative that being gay is somehow a threat to the state itself.
Tyra Demant is the director of Amnesty International's Gender, Sexuality, and Identity program. Thank you very much, Tyra.
Thank you so much.
I'm Marco Werman. Marvel Comics' Black Panther comes to the big screen, and one of the cast, at least one, is undocumented.
No one really talks about their status, especially when you're black and you're an immigrant. If you're from Africa or if you're from the Caribbean, no one talks about it.
But Bamba John Bamba is talking. His story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Is it Twitter or the way Trump uses it? Well, a bit of both, probably. Yesterday, we told you about President Trump retweeting anti-Muslim videos posted by a British far-right group called Britain First. Officials in the UK call it an extremist organization. One of its leaders was recently convicted of a hate crime. British Prime Minister Theresa May criticized Trump's retweets as the wrong thing to do. Trump's response was to tweet this message at the Prime Minister: "Don't focus on me, focus on the destructive radical Islamic terrorism that is taking place within the United Kingdom." Beyond the social media drama, though, we wanted to hear more about Britain First and about the response in the UK. David Lammy is the British Member of Parliament for Tottenham in North London, one of the most diverse constituencies in all of the UK. David, thank you very much for being with us. First of all, who are Britain First and what role do they play in British politics currently?
Britain First is an extreme right-wing group whose leaders have been engaged in criminal acts of hate crime, pulling the veils off Muslim women and things like that in the street. They are a group that hound and harass Britain's ethnic minority population, any right-thinking person reading their website would be deeply disturbed by the kind of things that they would publish and say about minority communities. They are absolutely a group that would assert white supremacy as a normal good thing, a group that you would associate with preferencing Anglo-Saxon communities, and a group that has been frankly horrendous in relation to Muslim communities, but also in relation to black and brown communities across Europe.
So prior to Donald Trump's retweet, was the government in London kind of critical enough of Britain First?
Well, it's a fringe organization. There are questions about whether it ought to be a prescribed organization, actually, but it is a fringe organization. And actually, what happens in the extraordinary situation that we're now in, where a president of the United States retweets a fringe organization, is he brings what is in the fringe into the mainstream. And let me just say that your listeners will recall that in Britain, we had the tragic murder of a sitting MP, Joe Cox, just under 18 months ago.
Right.
And the individual that murdered her shouted Britain First at the point that he did that. And he was being seduced by some of their extreme language. So this is a very, very, very serious business. And as was been said today in the British Parliament, it really is time for Donald Trump to stop tweeting, to get off Twitter, to stop these statements that seem to come out of nowhere, but actually are low, are cruel, are mean, and really hurt people who are so, so, so much less powerful than he is.
What has been the response of your constituents in Tottenham to all of this?
He's a very unpopular figure in a constituency like mine. He's an unpopular figure, I think, broadly throughout the United Kingdom. And that's why many people petition the UK Parliament to say that he should not be allowed into this country. We have had debates in the UK Parliament that he should not be allowed a state visit to this country. And I think that damaging our ability to deal with terrorist events, damaging our community relations in the way that he is now seeking to do, and really interrupting a relationship that we've had with the United States for now decades and decades of a special relationship is something that is deeply disturbing to the vast majority of people in Britain. And let me, as you say, it unites people in different political parties and different political traditions.
Do you think it's going to embolden extremist groups like Britain First?
Well, we're seeing right across the developed world an emboldening of extremist views. We are seeing an acceptability to Islamophobia that I think is unprecedented. This is a very, very disturbing moment for those of us who believe in democracy, who believe in dialogue and discussion, who take the view that there can be different views on the centre-right and centre-left of politics, but we should always resist extremism that seeks to pick on groups of people, particularly when they are minority communities.
David Lammy, MP for Tottenham in North London, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
One of the ways we bring you stories from around the world here on the show is by speaking to the journalists who are covering them. Example, we're about to hear from Amy Ferris-Rotman, a reporter based in Russia, about the ongoing investigation into Russian efforts to interfere in last year's U.S. election. But as you will hear from Amy, covering this story from Russia is almost impossible.
It's extremely frustrating. We don't get any access to the people and the events that we're meant to get access to. Every time there's a new twist and turn in this story, every time the US finds a new character or a new group of characters has met the Trump campaign, we all think, oh God, please no, which is not really the attitude a journalist usually does have. I mean, you know, a journalist usually is on the story, is excited, but not in this case, because it's like, oh God, you know, another attempt that we're going to have to do at finding the relevance of why these usually quite random characters end up on the other side of the Atlantic trying to convince Trump that they have information. I mean, most of these people have absolutely no power in Russia. This has been something else which we in the Foreign Press Corps here have been trying to hammer out, you know, over and over again, although people don't seem to really listen to us.
Can you meet with sources? Can you call, like, who can you call in the Kremlin about this story?
Well, who can we call in the Kremlin? Absolutely nobody. Russia is a very closed place. It's a very closed place for its own journalists, for foreign correspondents even more so. It's not like the US where, you know, over years or over some time, you can develop a source in the White House, someone who you can trust and that you trade information with. It's not like that here. It's basically a sealed up institution and there's no way for us to get into it.
Does the Kremlin want to know what you know? Are your phones tapped? Are you followed?
There's definitely a lot of paranoia. There's a lot of mistrust. I think it's pretty clear that all of our communications are tapped in some form. I mean, that's a kind of, we operate by this, by an unwritten rule book. And there are various rules in this book. And of course, one of the rules is there are certain things you never, ever report on, which is to do with the wealth and personal lives of the people at the very top of government here. You have a pretty safe assumption that everything that you write and speak on the phone and your activities are being monitored. But anyone who thinks they're not is being very naive.
What about your Russian colleagues? What kind of difficulties, impediments are they facing?
It was no surprise to me that the only cracks in the Trump-Russia story have come from Russian journalists working for Russian publications here. So I think that's very telling. Being from Russia, having Russian as a native language, having family who are here, all of that makes a Russian journalist that much more attractive, if you will, but also that much more open to receiving information in a way that we can't. As Western journalists, we are simply not trusted.
Describe those cracks. What are they?
So we saw a couple of them recently, and they followed one right after the other. In mid-October, TV Rain, which is Dozhd, which means rain in Russian, it's the country's only independent TV channel. It's entirely web-based. And they were actually able to record an interview with a member from one of these notorious troll factories. And the troll told TV Rain that they were forced to watch the Netflix series House of Cards, which I was just finding hilarious.
That's incredible.
To watch House of Cards to understand American politics. And then a day later, Russia's RBK, massive, massive media group, they published a months-long investigation into the operations of the troll factories. And they actually proved a link that the troll factories were focusing on U.S. elections last year.
Yeah. The Kremlin has never really been especially friendly to foreign correspondents, but now some of your colleagues have been labeled foreign agents. Who's fallen into that camp and how has that threat changed your job?
I don't know how many have actually been labeled it yet. Some have received letters saying they will be named it. There's nine companies which are in the firing line. The most prominent and the one that has no government funding, the one that's most shocking to us all, is CNN. All of us are just kind of shaking our heads thinking what on earth is going to happen next. Yet again, Trump and Putin are seeing eye to eye. So CNN, Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Deutsche Welle, which is the German public broadcaster, and a few other news outlets which are funded by foreign government. They're being targeted. These are the ones we know about. Anyone could be labeled a foreign agent going forward.
Correspondent Amy Ferris-Rotman there. She's based in Moscow. Native American Heritage Month is a time to honor and recognize the first people of this country and to learn more about their often neglected traditions and history. On this, the last day of November, we're going to do that through music. The world's Brandy Fullwood has more.
It's not uncommon to hear Christian music sung in native languages. Listen to this. This hymn, Sinners Can You Hate the Savior, is sung by Choctaw Community Singers. It's part of the Smithsonian Folkways Archives, and it's considered one of the common ways Choctaw, the language, was preserved. Today, Samantha Crane, a Choctaw musician from the small town of Shawnee, Oklahoma, is preserving the language in her own way. She's been performing, recording, and writing songs since 2007. Her music mixes together folk, pop, blues, and of course the influence of Woody Guthrie, a troubadour hero from her home state. On her latest album, You Had Me at Goodbye, Samantha sings about love and small-town struggles, but one song, Red Sky, Blue Mountain, stands out. It was written and performed in her native Choctaw. As Crane explains, she's using the Choctaw language to reimagine the culture and push it past its colonial influence.
Something that I'm trying to focus on with Red Sky, Blue Mountain is writing a song that is what I kind of consider to be a new traditional.
Crane's Red Sky, Blue Mountain is definitely more than translation into the Choctaw language. It's an attempt to expand past memory as well as expectation and write songs that bring together a larger group of Choctaw.
That's the way to keep something alive, is to keep it pliable and to keep it evolving with the people that are in the culture. The culture doesn't change. The traditions that are involved in it change.
Crane made a conscious effort to create a song that is not only beautiful, but something that sounds different. Her process seems to consider the ways in which her music incorporates and speaks for others.
Initially, whenever we were recording this song, I wanted to make the instrumentation a bit more modern. I didn't want it to be a mimic of what somebody would think a Native American song would sound like, because every tribe has something different. Some tribes use drums, some tribes use sticks.
The words she's singing in this song translate as, "A red sky, blue mountain, born to change the world, and we did. But what have we done?" She wrote the song after seeing fellow Choctaws and indigenous people from other tribes protest the pipeline at Standing Rock.
And so the idea behind that song is that it's kind of a focus on this natural scene, but a focus on a scene in nature which is sort of post-apocalyptic, where the colors have kind of gone opposite of what is, I think, how we see things being, like, in a more picturesque nature picture.
Even though the protest at Standing Rock is over, the effects of what happened at the camps and the call for solidarity has had a rippling effect in Indian country and Crane's music. Red Sky, Blue Mountain isn't necessarily a protest song, but it is a reminder and reference to those she knew at Standing Rock. The song enforces the connection and respect to land, which is an integral part of her Choctaw culture.
I really do truly believe the only way to keep a culture alive and breathing and actually, you know, relevant to each other is to keep them connecting with each other and talking to each other.
For the world, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
You can check out a video about Samantha Crane over at PRI.org. Brandy's story was co-reported and co-produced by The World's Allison Herrera as part of our Future Folk collaboration with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. Here's more music from Samantha Crane. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World, and I'm with Roopa Shenoy here in our studios. Hey, Roopa.
Hey, Marco.
So you've undoubtedly been following the news in Washington about DACA, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So the backstory here, everybody, talks in Washington have stalled over the fate of undocumented people brought to the U.S. as children. And last month, Trump gave Congress a six-month deadline to find a solution before DACA expires, DACA being Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that program. The programs allowed roughly 800,000 people to stay in the U.S. legally. And right in the midst of this growing urgency and anxiety, an actor in the soon-to-be-released Marvel superhero movie Black Panther has come out as a DACA recipient. Who is this guy, Roopa?
His name is Bambajam Bamba, and his family came to the States when he was 10. They're from Ivory Coast, and his uncle was actually the finance minister, and he describes just like beautiful childhood on a ranch house with horses, and then there was a civil war, and his family fled to the States.
Did they apply for asylum here?
Yeah, they did, but they didn't get it. Bamba eventually got DACA, and he's been in Hollywood ever since, working his way up. And if you watch TV just like a moderate amount, you probably recognize his face because he's had a lot of supporting roles. Do you ever watch Grey's Anatomy?
I've seen it a few times.
Or there's The Good Place.
Not in a long time.
So I asked him what it's like to be undocumented and a rising star in Hollywood.
I get offers, you know, to shoot movies in France, and I can't really go. Sometimes I'm like, well, maybe if I audition and I'm good enough, the studio or the production company will find a way and fight for me to kind of get whatever document I need to travel and come back. But it's an uphill battle.
But the whole time you were really scared, right, to say anything about your status in a big way because you were afraid it would come back on you in some way, right? So why now?
Well, yeah, no one really talks about their status, especially when you're black and you're an immigrant. If you're from Africa or if you're from the Caribbean, no one talks about it. We all know that people are going through it, but there's this thing that no one talks about it. There's just like, oh, I'll pray for you. Oh, I'll pray for you. I'm not sure if I answered your question. Did I answer your question?
You kind of did, but the question was, why now? And I was kind of getting around to like, is it now a little bit because of the Black Panther movie coming out, because it is going to be so big. Will that protect you at all?
Well, we haven't heard from Marvel yet what they think about this whole thing. But honestly, it really has nothing to do with why I'm coming out now. I'm really coming out now because the administration decided that they want to cancel DACA. I feel like DACA has given me so many opportunities to fulfill my dream and my goals in Hollywood. And I've been given this platform in part because of DACA. You know, I kind of feel like a fraud if people with so much less than me are coming out to fight and I'm sitting there hiding in the corner. I also have a daughter now. She's about to turn one. And I mean, I just can't be scared anymore. I can't sit back and just watch the news and sit and pray. I have to fight.
So, okay. Sorry, I'm going to harp on this a little bit because I watched the trailer to Black Panther.
Tell me something. What do you know about Wakanda?
It's a third world country.
Textiles, shepherds, cool outfits. All the front. Explorers have searched for it. Called it El Dorado. They looked for it in South America. But it was in Africa the whole time.
Have you thought about how your experience resonates with the movie coming out? Because, and I know you've signed a non-disclosure agreement. You can't say anything much more than, you know, you're a military leader.
Right.
But from the trailer, you can tell this movie has a lot of black and African pride. And the story, speaking back to colonialism in Africa, portraying a black society as the most technologically advanced in the world.
Yeah.
Those are really powerful statements.
Amazing. Amazing. I mean, I've been wanting to be in this movie for years. We all kind of heard the echoes in Hollywood. Oh, they're making a Black Panther movie. Black Panther's happening. And just being on set, I mean, it was just amazing. You look all around, everyone's black. You look at this kind of movie and what it represents right now for Africa, for Africans. It's just amazing to just be a part of that movie. And I mean, the icing on the cake was to end up in the trailer. I was watching the game at some bar, the NBA playoffs, and I literally ran all around the bar like, yeah, I made the trailer. So, I mean, it's a big deal for me to be a part of this production. Absolutely. So I hope that that will help amplify my message about undocumented people like me.
So you're asking people to do something, right? You want them to sign a petition.
Well, my goal in all this, right, is to encourage people, especially in Hollywood, who are DACA, who are undocumented, to come out and tell their stories. Because the more people tell their stories, I believe, in the industry, the more studios and production company networks are going to come behind us to support us.
Are you still scared? Or do you at least have some liberation from that fear that you've been dealing with your whole life?
Well, yeah, there's kind of, I mean, I'm still taking everything in because it's just moving like so fast. But there's definitely like a relief, like, okay, I just let the whole world in about who I am. So there's really nothing to hide. What you see is what you get. So there's definitely that kind of freedom. But at the same time, I mean, when you're putting yourself in the position as being an advocate and as being a leader of a cause that a lot of people don't agree with, obviously that comes with whatever consequences that comes with. But hopefully I could enroll people in the conversation so that they know my story and so that they can say at least that, hey, I know an undocumented immigrant.
That was the world's Rupa Shenoy with Bambajan Bamba, an actor who appears in the upcoming Black Panther movie. One last note today about a story we're getting ready for tomorrow. It's about American performer Josephine Baker. You may already know her. The first black superstar danced in a banana skirt, Paris, the 1920s. That part's been told before, but did you know this?
I'm glad to see this day come to pass. This day,
Josephine Baker on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, 1963, talking civil rights at the March on Washington. It brought her back from France to stand with Martin Luther King Jr. We go out today with Josephine Baker, this time singing.
C'est moi qui suis sa petite, son nanana, son anamite. Je suis vivre, je suis charmante, comme un petit oiseau qui chante. Il m'appelle sa petite bourgeoise, satan kiki, satan kinoise. D'autres lui ont les doux yeux, mais c'est moi qui l'aime.
We'll hear a lot more from Josephine Baker tomorrow on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Till then.
Il m'appelle sa petite bourgeoise, satan kiki, satan kiki, satan kinoise. D'autres lui ont les doux yeux, mais c'est moi qui l'aime le mieux.
PRI, Public Radio International.